Locked On NBA. The biggest stories, the local experts. Every Monday, we dig into the biggest stories in the NBA with the Locked On Podcast Network hosts. Today, we'll stop in Denver to speak with Adam Mares of Locked On Nuggets about Denver's unassuming and perhaps underreported start to the season. We go to LA to speak with Charles Mockler of Locked On Clippers about the up and down form of the Clippers over the last couple of weeks. And lastly, we go to Atlanta to speak with Brad Rowland of Locked On Hawks about Trae Young's injury and one of the worst teams in the Eastern Conference, the Atlanta Hawks. It's all coming up, the biggest stories with the local experts on Locked On NBA.
You are Locked On the NBA, part of the Locked On Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome back to another week of Locked On NBA, your last week of the 2019 year. I am your Monday host, Josh Lloyd. I also host the Locked On Fantasy Basketball podcast, and I'm the lead analyst at BasketballMonster.com and at Yahoo Sports Australia. We are going to talk about a couple of really strong teams out west and one of the teams in the Eastern Conference that is struggling a little bit. We're trying to figure out what exactly is going on in Atlanta. So let's get to it. Now let's bring in the host, or one of the hosts, of the Locked On Nuggets podcast. Adam Mares is here with me today to talk about the Denver Nuggets, a team that I think people may be surprised to see is the number two seed out in the Western Conference, 22-9 at the moment. Adam, there's been so many things written and tweeted and talked about how the Nuggets are struggling and what's wrong with Jokic and how this team, what are they doing? Yet they sit 22-9, you know, winning 8 out of their last 10, generally rolling at the moment with a record that is... I believe, superior to this point last season. Why is there just so much negativity around this team who is, you know, playing, I guess, at expectation, maybe even above expectation?
Well, it's actually the best start in franchise history. So you can go back all the way 52 years of Denver Nuggets basketball, and this is the best one. But, you know, to your point, it has felt a little bit underwhelming despite the numbers. And I think a lot of that has to do with the start, you know, the first 15 or so games of Nikola Jokic's season. He was clearly in some sort of slump, you know, emotionally. He looked like he was just miserable, but also the way he was playing. And then there were some high-profile games on national television where Denver just looked terrible. I think their worst games of the year have all come on national TV. So you combine all those things together, and I think that's where their perception comes from. But if you look over the last 10 or so games, 10, 15 games, you know, the second half of the season so far, Denver has really started to turn it on, and Nikola Jokic especially has really started to turn it on.
There is a consistent narrative around Jokic that he is a slow starter to the season, and it takes until the middle of December for him to kick it off again, and it appeared that that happened again this season. A, is that accurate? And B, if it is, why?
It's absolutely accurate. It's funny, if you go all the way back to his sophomore season, you know, he had that great rookie season on about 20 minutes per game. But in his sophomore season, Yusuf Nurkic was coming back from injury and got the starting center position. Jokic moved to forward, and that didn't work. It took some 30 games before the team sort of readjusted around Jokic. And I think we looked at that and said, oh, well, that was circumstantial. That was because of, you know, the trying to pair two centers on the court. That's why he started slow. And then, again, it happened last year, and I think some people thought, okay, well, Murray's taking on a bigger role. That's why Jokic started slow. This is the first year where you saw the slump extend for several weeks when everything was sort of set for Jokic to have a great start to the season, the continuity, you know, whatever, and he got off to that slow start again. So I do think there is something to Jokic coming back from break, especially this year where it was a shorter one, just coming back from break, it takes him a little bit of time to get warmed up and maybe even a little bit of time to get in shape.
Yeah, look, there was a lot of criticism about his body shape coming into the season and the beginning of the season, and talking about how he looked out of breath and all that sort of stuff. But part of that issue was, and some of that, yeah, may be true, and it possibly is true, but Yeah, a lot of it was the fact that his usage was way down at the beginning of the season as well. He was shooting, what, minus 20% on threes, which is, you know, jump back up in December. Yeah. And some of that can be attributed to your, you know, physical conditioning and whether you can get your legs under you and all that sort of stuff. But it also just appears to be a mindset thing with him as well, that he just has this thing where he's like, well, I'm not going to take over these games. I'm going to let other people do it. I'm going to just, you know, play my part. And then he goes, oh, well, maybe it's time now for me to get serious. And then it's, you know, all hell breaks loose and he just starts dominating. And I don't really understand why he has that consistent break to start the season. Is it just a matter of, we know that other teams and coaches are trying to figure out their rotations at the start of the season. Denver didn't really have that problem because the team was almost intact coming back. But is it just a, let's just ease into it sort of a mentality?
Yeah, I do think there's something to, you know, for bigs, especially big guys, seven footers, and even heavier, you know, bigger, bulkier seven footers. It's an 82 game season, and that's a lot of wear and tear on the body. And we know historically, guys like Shaq using that first 6-7 weeks or whatever to sort of cruise control before starting to turn it on. What I think happened this year, Jokic, a really good player, despite what maybe some casual analysts or casual fans think. Jokic, a really good player, and his worst is still really, really good. And I think what happened this year, Denver was off to a great start. I think 13-3 right out of the bat, and he wasn't playing well. And I think he looked at it and said, this is great. I'm not trying too hard. I'm not playing too, you know, I'm not overexerting myself in October and November, and the team is still winning. But there was the turning point for me was that Lakers game about 3 weeks ago, 3 to 4 weeks ago, where Denver had been in all these close games where Jokic had played terrible for three quarters, and then the fourth quarter he turned it on. Well, in that game, he tried to go at Anthony Davis and sort of win, and it looked like every other game of the season so far, Denver struggles, start the fourth quarter behind, and then you win it close at the end behind Jokic's brilliant fourth. And in that game, Anthony Davis shut him down and really just kind of dominated him. And I think it was sort of a low point for him where he looked at himself and said, this is, you know, I got to get in better shape. I got to get more aggressive, and I got to get my confidence back. And from that, I think it's now 14 games since then. You're looking at Jokic putting up something like 23 points, 10 rebounds, 8 assists over that stretch of, I don't know, 12, 13 games. And you mentioned the three-point shooting. He's up above 40% over that stretch as well. So I think he just had to, you know, sort of look himself in the mirror and prod himself a little bit to get back to his best self. But I think he's there now.
Let's move on from the All-NBA All-Star Center to what's happening with the bench unit, and we'll start with Michael Porter Jr., who has been up and down, in and out of the rotation. We saw him get some extra minutes last game with Paul Millsap out. How have you seen Porter's beginning to his NBA career, the first 22 games, even though he's only playing nine minutes a game?
It's been really fascinating. You know, the first thing, Denver has probably 11 or 12 guys that would be in almost every rotation. So there's somebody, if Michael Porter's going to play, he's kicking out somebody that Michael Malone feels at least a little bit confident in sticking out there. So you mentioned the minute totals. There's a lot of games where he's playing 5 minutes. He basically, the rotation now is that he gets one stretch in the first half, and depending on how the game is going, he'll get a second stint in the second half. So if Denver is winning big, he'll get 10, 11, 12 minutes. If they're not, he'll get about 5 or 6. And so I think that's really tough. Just first of all, just for him, it's tough to know you basically only get a short stretch, often broke up between the end of the first and beginning of the second, so a very fragmented 5-minute stretch. And I think that's been tough. His confidence, I think, got a little shaken. But the story with Porter, and maybe why he hasn't gotten more minutes, he seems to, and he's even admitted this a little bit, he's not familiar with the terminology, the playbook even, and he's just lost a lot on things that you can't be lost on if you're going to get minutes. You can't go into the half court and not know where you're supposed to be on any given play or what your role is on that play. And him being there for a whole year last season as basically a redshirt, I think that's maybe the most disappointing thing about him from the coach's perspective, is that he's taking a lot more time than they anticipated just to bring him up to NBA speed on basic terminology and things.
With those bench guys, you know, Porter's getting minutes, and then they've got guys like Juancho Hernangómez. And the other guy who's had times where he's had to miss out is Malik Beasley, a guy who's coming up to restricted free agency. A lot of people talking about him last season, but he's sort of been, it's been a weird one for him. And even recently, like, he played three really strong games and then pretty much out of the rotation across the weekend. So what is happening? Is it just a, I've just got to try different players here from Malone, or depending on the matchup, or is it certain things that he's seeing from Beasley that's causing him to come in and out of the rotation? And what do you think that means for his future? Because his name name is one of the most commonly bandied about names in terms of trade discussions.
He's a really interesting one. If it was solely about how to win each game night in and night out, there's no question Malik Beasley would be in the rotation. I think he's one of the six or seven best players on the Nuggets roster. Denver tried to reach an extension agreement with him over the summer and couldn't. And I got the sense that there is, and I continue to get the sense that there is a sort of understanding that he is not going to be part of the long-term plans. I would be shocked if he was not traded sometime before this year's trade deadline. And I think when Denver's looking at, okay, we have 12 guys that all deserve minutes, who gets cut out? Well, one of the guys you cut out is the guy that is probably gone in a couple of weeks, months, whatever, anyway. And so to me, that's sort of what has happened with him. You don't want to get a guy injured when he's on the trade block. You don't want to waste resources and minutes or whatever, you know, garbage time or second quarter, up 10, whatever. You don't want to waste those on a guy that's out the door. So I think that's the deal with Malik Beasley. But when he has played, he's played really, really well, especially on the offensive end.
Yeah, it is going to be interesting to see what Denver does because they do have this huge depth which could be consolidated into another piece. But that's all going to unfold over the next couple of weeks and months. Adam, you'll have it all covered for us over on Locked On Nuggets. Thanks for jumping on Locked On NBA with me.
Thanks for having me.
Now I'm joined by one of the hosts of the Locked On Clippers podcast. Charles Mockler is here with me to talk about a Clippers team that's been a little bit up and down of late. But Charles, it appears that there is some sort of illness going through the locker room at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty – last night we happened to be at the game, and we saw Trez in the locker room kind of before he was ruled out, and he was complaining about feeling cold all over his body. He mentioned he was, I think, you know, with his kids over the break, so I think he was sick from that. And then Kawhi at the podium just looked, you know, like he needed a giant bowl of chicken noodle soup. So it definitely feels like some guys are – I mean, most of the guys seem under the weather right now for sure.
That obviously was an impact in that game against Utah. They lost by 13 on Saturday, but it's been a weird sort of, you know, one win, one loss situation for the last, you know, 2-3 weeks here for this Clippers team, and that can't be attributed to illnesses. So what's with the up and down? Like a win against the Wolves, they lose against the Bulls. They beat the Suns, they lose to the Rockets. They beat the Spurs, they lose to the Thunder. They beat the Lakers, they lose to the Jazz. Like, why is there so much inconsistency here?
It really, I mean, we've kind of felt like a broken record sometimes on the podcast, but, you know, we've had one game with a fully healthy roster. And even, you know, with Trez being ruled out of that Utah game, we've still only had one game with a fully healthy roster. So I think there's continuity. I think we were kind of spoiled with how well Paul George played offensively when he first came back, and we thought things were going to kind of continue like that. But he's been in a bit of a slump. But I chalk it up to continuity and guys just not completely clicking yet. We've seen kind of flashes of it, you know, against the Lakers, the comeback, everything looked, you know, like it looked kind of what this team, what some people think should look like at this point, but it's getting there, and hopefully we can kind of continue with this somewhat continuity despite the flu situation going on right now.
Paul George has had a history, you know, throughout his career of being, I don't know, up and down, having really hot months and really cold months, mm-hmm. and yeah, I don't know if we're in the middle of one of those stretches, but historically in December, he's been a 40% three-point shooter, and he's always fallen off towards that. March, December, and January have been his hot times of the season, so he's sort of flipping the script a little bit there. But as you said, the beginning of the season from him was unsustainably good in terms of that level. But how have we seen how everything's fitting in? Like, there's been some chopping and changing. Sometimes we have Patrick Patterson starting for Mo Harkless. You have, you know, games where Landry Shamet plays 18 minutes or he plays 30 minutes. How much of this is just Doc trying to figure out what's going on because of the injuries, or there's just players being inconsistent and it's going with a little bit of a hot hand type situation?
I think it's a little of both. The Patterson situation is odd. It's kind of like when Marcin Gortat was kind of our, like, quote-unquote starting center for times last year, and he'd play like 10 minutes to start and then just kind of not show up again. So that kind of seems to be what Patterson's role is right now. As far as how it's looked, I think the minutes thing is really interesting. A lot of fans, I myself included, kind of wonder, you know, Zubac doesn't get very many minutes unless Trez is out, which is something, and, you know, Trez has obviously played very well and it's hard to keep him off the floor. But I think Doc is kind of just having a tested out time right now with minutes and rotations. He said it in the Lakers game. Jermichael didn't play the first half, and he said that was on him at the end of the game. That was a bad decision on his part. So I think those are kind of signs that he's still figuring it out with the continuity still getting evened out.
You talk about Zubac, and I hear a lot of, you know, complaining about him not playing as much, but he can't really play alongside Harrell. So in order for him to play more minutes, then Montrez needs to play fewer minutes. And I don't think that's something the Clippers are going to look to. So it is good having that ability to have a center who's, you know, playing as solidly as Zubats is, and they can go with him in certain situations. But yeah, how realistically do we increase his playing time?
See, that's what's so hard is that Zubats does a lot of great things. He's a, you know, a very good rim protector. Last night, you know, when he's really locked in and doesn't commit perhaps silly fouls, he can make players like Gobert look average. But like I just said, Trez is making it. It's not like Trez is playing poorly, and that's why we want Zubats to get time. It's this thing of they're both playing so well. Harrell is having another career year, which, you know, if you're Zubats, there's nothing you can do about. So I think there might have to be a drop-off in Trez's play, or Zoo might have to show a little more discipline with the fouls. And I really think that's it, because he put, you know, when he was called upon specifically last night, it was the first time in the season when it was like, okay, you're kind of the guy at the five right now. He answered the call pretty well. So I think he just has to keep doing that. And I guess in a weird way, not hope, but Trez is going to have to play poorly for Zoo to crack 20 plus minutes a game for a sustained period of time.
What's the status on Patrick Beverley and his wrist? He had to leave the last game with a wrist issue. It looked like it could have been something serious. He's popped up on the injury report for Tuesday as questionable. Like, where are we at with Beverley and that wrist issue, and what happens if he has to miss time?
Oof. Luckily, he came back to that game and then not only blocked a shot with his hurt wrist, but also challenged Gobert at the rim at one point with the hurt wrist. So the mentality is as if the wrist is fine. But Doc said in the post game that they had an x-ray, there wasn't a break or anything like that, so that was avoided. But he did mention that Bev was kind of having trouble gripping the ball, like palming the ball, so I'm not so sure. I mean, if that got worse or didn't get any better, I don't see him playing. The game on Tuesday's at 2 p.m., so I think that factors into it as well. But if he can't go, then I think we might see, I mean, Lou in the starting lineup, maybe Sham and Magruder. I don't know. It's a really big loss. I mean, we saw it last night. There were some other factors, but when Bev was off the floor, it kind of took the team a while to get locked back into it. So it's going to be interesting if he can't play.
We saw when he missed games at the early portion of December that Terrence Mann started, but it was Derek Walton who was getting those minutes. How did you think Walton filled in that time, and would he be a guy that could just sort of go out there and just not get in his own way to allow all these other players to sort of take over?
That's a perfect way to say, to describe what Derek Walton does. He knows exactly what he's supposed to do. He doesn't really make too many mistakes. He's cashed in his three-point shot when he's had the opportunities. I would love it if Derek Walton got some more minutes and stuff like that. He's obviously kind of leapfrogged Terrence Mann in the, you know, kind of like that, the those fringe player hierarchy. So there is a chance we could see him against Sacramento, which now that you mentioned, I think there's a pretty good chance we'll see him.
Well, it is going to be interesting to see if this Clippers team can get things back on track. They are currently sitting as the fifth seed in the West, but it is weird because they've played significantly more games than those teams above them. They're 23-11, whereas that's 34 games. The Mavericks have played just 31. The Rockets have played 32. The Nuggets have played 31 games. So all those teams, the Clippers could not even play, and those other teams lose, and they jump ahead of them in the standings. So they're sitting okay, but I guess the recent run of form has been marginally disappointing. We'll see how it all turns around. You'll have it covered for us all over on Locked On Clippers as things unfold. Thank you, Charles, for coming on Locked On NBA.
Thank you so much, Josh.
Now let's bring in the host of the Locked On Hawks podcast. Brad Rowland is here with me. Atlanta currently sits at 6-27. And for those of you keeping note at home, that is three games worse than the New York Knicks at the bottom of the Eastern Conference. Brad, it got worse somehow with Trae Young hurting his ankle a couple of games ago. First off, with Trae, how long are we expecting his absence to last?
It kind of remains to be seen. He's already been ruled out for Monday's game. We will see how long it lasts. He actually bounced back very quickly from a relatively similar injury a few weeks ago during the early portion of the season. And all indications are that it's not too serious. But anytime you're dealing with an ankle, and given where the Hawks are, they might want to be pretty comfortable, I would say safe with him. But then Hawks don't play again until Friday. So a little bit of extra rest. And I think Trae should be back sooner rather than later.
So in the two games that Young has missed, we'll count that Bucks game as one, him missing, they have lost by a combined 61 points. to the Chicago Bulls and the Milwaukee Bucks, and I don't need to tell anybody that's horrible. They had that bad loss to the Knicks by 23 points a couple of weeks ago. They haven't won in, you know, seems like forever. John Collins has been suspended. He is back now. So let's talk a little bit negative first. Yeah, what's happening with this team? Now, there was a lot of hype, I guess, in the offseason of push to the playoffs, but when you look at most of the moves that they made, they got worse on most of those trades and decisions that they did make in the offseason. Is this a by-design tank sort of maneuver? Let's just get our young guys in, play the minutes, or do they actually think that these moves would make them competitive and it just hasn't turned out that way?
Yeah, first, I agree with you. I think if you look at what they did in the offseason, it was certainly not designed to win right away. Travis Schlenk, the team's GM, actually said on the record that they were projecting internally about 30 wins this season, and they're not on that pace anymore, obviously. But with the John Collins suspension for all that time and now Trey with some injury stuff, it isn't crazy to think that this could have been a 30-win roster. But, I mean, it's kind of a team that's constructed that's very, very young. They do have some intriguing, talented pieces, but a lot of youth and not a lot of veteran talent on this team. They downgraded from Kent Bazemore to Evan Turner. They went from Dwayne Dedman to not really having a starting center this season. So I'm not sure if it was a tank by design, but it certainly was a, you know, they're rebuilding to be sure, and they were not obviously pushing their chips in the middle for this season, because the only thing they actually did that was a sort of a win now-ish kind of thing was signing Jabari Parker. And while that isn't like a disaster so far, it's not going to move the needle too much.
In terms of, you know, these moves that they've made, look, there is, yeah, obviously development in a lot of this stuff, but let's focus on a positive now, Trae Young's play. Now, do you think, assuming he is back after missing the game on Monday, he's back for the next contest at the end of the week, do you think he's going to be an all-star?
I think he probably will be, because guys that have his numbers just don't miss the All-Star game very often. There is the concern, obviously, with the team record being as bad as it is, and of course his defensive concerns and the fact that he's never been there before. It's not an absolute lock in the way that you might expect it to be for someone who's averaging like 29-9 this season. You see those numbers, and those are All-Star numbers to be sure, but if the team doesn't win, it is going to be a little bit harder for him to get in, and because coaches are ultimately picking the team, they might lean veterans. I still think that he probably will get in, but it isn't going to be as clear as you might expect it to be, probably.
I expect him to make it as well, because again, those numbers, they're pretty hard to deny, and you can just see the impact, like when he goes off, like how bad this team actually looks, even with John Collins doing a huge amount of work in that game. Against the Bulls on the weekend, they still weren't able to really compete there. But these other young players, DeAndre Hunter, who they traded quite a bit to get in the draft, they selected Cam Reddish with the extra pick they got in the Doncic-Young swap last season. How have you seen those two guys, in particular Hunter, thrust into the starting lineup from day one? Reddish has been in and out of that starting lineup. He's back in at the moment with Young out. How have you seen those two guys through the first 30 games of their NBA career?
I think for the most part, it's about what I expected. You know, Hunter is someone who came in with a little bit more of a pedigree, a little bit older prospect, probably a little bit safer, ready to contribute now. And we've seen some flashes of that. He's still a rookie, so there are games and nights where he looks bad, like a rookie looks, but there have been enough flashes where he seems to be a competent rotation player already, and that's kind of what you want to see from a rookie, even if he's just an older guy who was probably a little bit overdrafted when compared to what you would normally think from a top five pick. But in that draft, it was probably pretty appropriate, although they gave up a lot for him, which is certainly looking to be a little bit questionable at this point. But Hunter definitely can play and does not look to be out of place, I should say, on an NBA court right now. Reddish has been hot and cold, I will say, mostly cold offensively. Offensively, it's a bit of a mess right now for Reddish, which isn't a surprise either. If you looked at what he did in college, this is kind of what you would expect, because this is definitely a long-term pick, more of an upside, you know, future-facing maneuver. I do think that defensively, Reddish has been pretty good so far this season, which is kind of sliding under the radar because the team is very bad defensively, and you know, he's a rookie and all that stuff. But actually, if you want to point out a positive, his defense has actually been pretty good this season. His offense has been overshadowing that with how poor it's been. But I think if you expected that coming in, which people that were paying attention probably did, it's not been a huge surprise. And overall, those guys have been just okay. Nothing great, nothing terrible either.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough. That defense has been strong from Reddish. The other stuff has been a struggle, and I think, yeah, something that should cause a level of concern is using the PIPM metric in terms of the rookies. Both Hunter and Reddish are in the bottom 10 rookies in those numbers, which is something of a concern, probably more of a concern for Cleveland, that Garland is absolutely dead last in that number. And Kevin Porter's also the fifth worst rookie in that metric too. So some of these players on these bad teams are having some struggles there, for thrust into roles that maybe they aren't ready for. What do you make of what's happening at the center position? We've seen your guys, Len starting, and then Damian Jones starting, and now Bruno Fernando starting, and three-man rotations and two-man rotations. Do you think we're going to see extended John Collins happening here at the center, or are they just going to continue to roll through these other guys playing that position?
I think it'll be a little bit of both. Collins has played more center this year than he ever has, but they don't want to, at least so far, they've not wanted to go with him as a more full-time center option. Part of that is because power forward is kind of a mess behind him. So if they don't want to do that, he's by far their best option at either spot. So they're kind of picking and choosing. My general opinion is that Alex Len has actually been pretty good. He got off to a slow start this season, but Alex Len has been by far their best option at center. That's not exactly a ringing endorsement, because Alex Len's probably better for you as a backup center than a starting center, but he is their best guy right now. They're starting very young with Bruno Fernando. He's not ready. That seems to me like a pure development move, because he's just certainly not ready to start right now. But for whatever reason, they kind of are keeping their options open. And I think, going back to what we talked about at the beginning, looking ahead to kind of a future facing kind of thing here, they're just experimenting, because I think if they're trying to win games and that was the only priority, it'd be a lot of Collins and a lot of Alex Len. But right now we're looking at Jones, looking at Fernando, and trying to see what works.
If you're going out with the idea of tanking, this is the way to do it. And you're not saying, then no one's going out to deliberately lose games, but their priority is trying to develop these guys. And I agree with you, Len is the best center on this team. He also seems to play better when he's in a reserve role, regardless of minutes. Like, give him the most minutes, but he's better in that reserve role versus being with the starters. But this is the way to do it, to give these guys an opportunity. They may not ever be ready, or they may not ever be developing into, you know, high-level players on a playoff team. But if you're going to see how it goes and then get losses in the interim, and you get more shots at getting more guys in, this is the way to go about it. So while it is tough to see these losses, you know, 20 points to the Knicks and 30-point losses and absolute blowouts, eventually you think that this stuff is going to benefit this team. But one last thing before we go, Brad, there's those whispers of Trae Young getting frustrated with the team, and those whispers, you know, someone, I think Shams was reported over The Athletic, that someone, a team official, was heard saying to Trae, no, don't worry, we'll get you some help. I think that would be the wrong move for the Hawks, in terms of their overall franchise. But how much of a sense do you get of Young being frustrated with what's going on?
I'm sure there is some of that. You know, the reporting from Shams and also from Chris Haynes has been out there. And I do think that if you're Trae Young and you're averaging 29 points a game on a team that's not doing much in terms of winning games, it would be easy to be frustrated. There's just the overall reporting on frustration in the locker room makes a lot of sense. This team is losing almost every night right now, and you know, a bunch of pros, I know they're not supposed to win, but guys that are losing, that don't want to be losing, are not going to be very happy. So I don't make too much of the reporting on that. I agree with you wholeheartedly on the notion of going out and getting him some help. It'd be fine if the Hawks traded for someone who was under contract for the future, but if they went out and did like a rental move, that would be a bad decision, because this team is not going to be doing anything this year. So yeah, no panic moves would be what I would say for what the team should be doing in the future. You want to invest, and they have a lot of cap space, like an overwhelming amount of cap space this summer. So they want to go out and make a move earlier rather than later to sort of secure someone that they want. I understand that, but I would be taking it slow and just trying to tell your young guys, particularly Trae Young, who's the face of the franchise now, like, we have to take it slow. We understand that the team needs to be better in the future. We get it. But right now, it's tough to go out and acquire someone that's going to fix all the problems.
It is a tough season for Hawks fans in terms of wins and losses, but watching the young guys develop is what the focus should be, and you will have all that covered for us, Brad, over on Locked On Hawks. So thanks for jumping on Locked On NBA with me.
My pleasure.
And that'll do it for another episode of Locked On NBA. Make sure you are following me on Twitter at @RedRock_Beeble and checking out all of the other shows across the Locked On Podcast Network, your favorite team across the NBA, the NFL, and Major League Baseball, with plenty of NHL teams and college programs there as well. Subscribe to your favorite show and give it a 5-star rating or review, and review, in fact. Guys, we are done here. Thank you so much for listening, everyone. See ya.